It's the Legal Toolkit with Jared Correa. With guests Justin and Luke Carey, we play a round of Brother Up. And then, did you know Jared's a master of the paleontologic arts? Neither did we, because that's not a thing. But he's still going to tell us all about dinosaurs. But first, your host, Jared Correa.
Yeah, that's right. It's time for the Legal Toolkit podcast. So you know I've got that dog in me today. Even if it's just a little chihuahua like the Taco Bell dog. And yes, it's still called the Legal Toolkit podcast. Even though I have no idea what Tight Bond 3 Ultimate Wood Glue does. That's a real thing, I guess. Though I'm pretty sure you shouldn't masturbate with it. I'm your host, Jared Correa. You're stuck with me because Andy Garcia is unavailable. He's too busy providing me with new tool references as well as sucking in The Godfather 3. I'm the CEO of Red Cave Law Firm Consulting, a business management consulting service for attorneys and bar associations. Find us online at redcavelegal.com. I'm the CEO of Gideon Software, an intake platform for law firms. Learn more and schedule a demo at gideonlegal.com. Now, before we get to our interview today about AI, featuring Justin and Luke Carey, brothers working in the legal and software industries, respectively, I wanted to take a moment to talk even more about AI, because why the fuck not? I mean, seriously, the week we're recording this, I'm doing 4 presentations on AI. Lawyers are just insatiable right now. It turns out AI is the ultimate aphrodisiac for the special attorney in your life. Lawyers are asking me regularly about data security and confidentiality with respect to inputting data into AI tools. That's especially true of generative AI tools, which everyone is starting to use or at least is aware of. And the question is always, should I put confidential data about my clients or cases into AI products? And the assumption that people tend to make when asking that question is that it applies to only one software at a time. But that may not be the case. Especially as we move forward in time, there are going to be increasing layers as to how AI is used in technology products, and that includes for legal technology products. Of course, it's sort of already happening. And let me tell you, this shit is tough to drill down on, even for single programs. So let's talk about ChatGPT, for example. That's the most popular generative AI tool in the world right now. Even the least tech-savvy, most dedicated Luddite attorneys are trying it out, as I mentioned. And there are a number of different ways that data is treated in ChatGPT, depending on the version. If you're accessing the free version of ChatGPT, your data is going to be used to train the model by default. But in both ChatGPT and ChatGPT Plus, that's a paid version of software, at a reasonable $20 a month, you can also access data controls and turn off chat history, which means that your prompt data won't be used to train the model. Now, a couple of weeks ago, OpenAI, that's the company that launched and manages ChatGPT, they released a helpful blog post about the use of temporary chat that the system won't remember, as well as how memory functions in the system. It's worth a read in this context if you want to learn more about this. Now, there's also a ChatGPT Enterprise, which is a business subscription model. And that, on the other hand, follows OpenAI's API guidelines, which means that data inputs, which are called prompts, won't be used to train the model by default. That means you won't have to toggle anything off. Are you lost yet? Of course, that's a lot of layers to peel off. But it's not all that different from the way that software systems have generally worked. The more you pay, the more features and security you get. And while other generative AI tools are not as mature as OpenAI's, I suspect a similar arrangement is going to be adopted by those other products as well moving forward. Now, let's enter Thunderdome, if you will. So imagine you're using AI tools within your case management software. If that feature is available now, it's not likely the case that that particular software company has developed and is using its own large language model to run those operations. That necessarily means, then, that it's using someone else's model and it's probably white labeling it. So it looks like it's part of their product. The advantage here is that they can use that model that's already pre-built and usually some of the functions around it, all while leveraging your case data as well, which they maintain in system. That'll give you more targeted results more quickly. That's a good thing. But in that context, you don't have the same control about how data is managed in that base system. You can't, for example, pierce that white label veil, if you even know it's there, to adjust that system the way you want to when it comes to data security. You sort of have to trust that your primary vendor is doing it right. Well, sort of. Stay tuned, because you can get aggressive about trying to unearth that process. Then what happens when you're using an integration with AI components? The same story may apply in terms of who owns the underlying tool, not the vendor you may expect. And in this scenario, you're at an even further remove. Data that you're inputting into one system can get pushed along to a second system that processes it using AI. Throw in a bridging tool like Zapier for when a direct integration isn't available, and we've got yet another layer in place. Now, just so you know, I'm not trying to make your life miserable or throw cold water on the AI revolution, which I absolutely think is a thing that is happening. The use of AI by law firms is going to be impactful, if not more impactful, as when law firms started adopting cloud solutions. I think that AI is, in fact, going to be perfectly helpful right up until it isn't. So when it goes rogue and kills us all. But until then, good. The immediate issue is how should you proceed in this current environment as an attorney? And there are three things that you should be thinking about doing. But there's no real big plot twist here. It's going to be the same three things you needed to do to review and manage the software you have right now before AI was ever commercially available. It's just that you're probably not doing it. So first, if you're going to use a software tool for your law firm business, and that's any software, AI or not, like Dropbox or Google Workspace, et cetera, pick up the paid version. It's been said many times, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And this has never been truer of a product than an AI software because it requires high volume testing to improve its functioning. Now, second, you need to vet every software you want to use before you buy it. And you need to understand its features. And that's in line with the comment, it's either going to be six or eight, depending on your state, to Rule 1.1, that's competency rule for lawyers, which indicates that lawyers, as part of their professional competency, need to be aware of the benefits and risks of the technologies they use in their practice. They need to keep abreast of that information. So the same way you would do in engaging any other vendor, you ask a lot of questions of those providers that are trying to sell you AI tools. Basically, you want to act like an annoying little kid. Find out where and how the data lives. Ask why and how it moves. Find out whether the vendor has built a proprietary tool for AI or is relying on another vendor's solution. That's that white label and integration issue. Ask if your data is being used to train the system or multiple systems. Ask about their data security and confidentiality policies. Record all the information you acquire and store it somewhere. Then, when you're comfortable, make your choice and buy the product. But unfortunately, your work isn't done at that point. Not quite yet, at least. You also have to stay on top of the technology you acquire. And this is a particularly vexing thing when it comes to AI, because the sheer pace of the technology advancement is staggering, more so than in almost any technology tool or tool set I've seen. So once you gain an understanding of the present day version of the technologies you're using, then you got to continue to learn about the development of those technologies by doing things like getting updated via the vendors' websites, including through blog posts, news releases, knowledge bases, following industry publications and thought leaders, setting up your own news alerts via search engines, and maybe more. But that's a pretty good start, honestly. And I do feel like this is something of a minimum competency standard, at least at that level. It's sort of similar to making sure you update your desktop softwares, which was a much bigger deal back in the day when not as many people were using cloud. Thus, we arrive at the third and last prong. See, I can still use lawyer words. You need to do these things to build a competent understanding of the AI tools and how you use them. But now you got to dive into the contracts. You got to read and understand the contracts that you have with your vendors. Now, this should be the easiest one of all because you're a freaking attorney. Every technology company you're going to work with will have a service level agreement, SLA, or end user license agreement, EULA. So if you're engaging a new vendor, review the entire contract and pay attention to the AI provisions. You know, search tools are really helpful here. You can find references to AI and artificial intelligence pretty easily. Now, the other little twist here is that, and this is a twist, if your current vendor has added AI features or tools, which a lot have, take a look at how their contracts have changed if they didn't have those tools before. And if the contract hasn't changed, I'd reach out to find out why. Pretty simple, right? Nah, I'm just fucking with you. I know this is a pain in the ass and just another notch on your to-do list, right? But you can get through it. I believe in you. After all, don't you want to maintain the last couple decades you have left before the AI starts to manage you? Now, before we talk with Luke and Justin in an AI and Molly-fueled romp, let's hear a little something-something from our sponsors. Then, we'll get into a rump roast that's all about brotherly love. Partner with Rankings.io, the marketing agency for law firms that want results, not excuses. With flat rates for Google ads, a track record ranking attorneys for the most competitive terms on Google, and a team always easy to reach by phone, even during off hours, Rankings.io is the agency of choice for firms that want the rankings, traffic, and cases other law firm marketing agencies just can't deliver. Visit Rankings.io for a free consultation and start seeing your firm grow. Simplify. With Cosmolex, the only fully integrated practice management solution. Everything you need, accessible anywhere. Trust and general accounting is built in, so you don't need QuickBooks. Cosmolex's Money Finder reminds you to bill for work you put into client matters so you don't leak money. That's messy. Lower cost, better business, and less frustration. Yes, please. It's all built in with Cosmolex. Free trial and take 20% off your first year at Cosmolex.com. Okay, everybody, it's time. Let's get to the meat in the middle of this legal podcasting sandwich. Today's meat is simply an AI-generated image of meat. I'm so sorry. All right, then, let's interview our guests. We have today, as first-time guests on the Legal Toolkit Show, but longtime brothers who, you can't see them, but they're wearing matching L.L. Bean vests right now. Totally appropriate, I think. We have Justin Carey, who's an attorney at Drummond Woodsum in Maine, and Luke Carey, who's the Associate Director of Machine Learning at Invitae. All right, Justin, Luke, how you guys doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Jared, how are you? Great to be on here. Thank you for having us. Thanks for letting me bring my brother along.
Doing great. Thanks for bringing me.
I've been looking forward to doing this for a little while, and I'm glad we got you scheduled. Since there's two of you, I'll indicate who I'm asking questions to, and you guys can jump in afterwards as well if one brother gives an answer and the other brother wants to comment. But Justin, we're doing like a legal podcast here, so I want to start with you. You're an attorney. You have this abiding interest in AI. I've heard you speak on the topic a number of times. You're really eloquent about it. You do a very nice job with it. So like, what drives your interest in artificial intelligence? And then how does it intersect with your law practice?
I am interested. I think the origin story was Luke would always play with like the precursor to Lego robotics were Minesweepers, I think. Is that what you'd play with, Luke?
Lego Mindstorm.
Lego Mindstorm. Right, yeah, yes. Mindstorm. And I never understood what was going on. And that ignorance has continued to this day. Whenever I talk about LLMs and all areas of AI with Luke, I feel like I'm just like in a world that is not English. And I am fascinated by it because it feels like it's like starting to creep into every area of practice for our law firm, right? So the firm I'm at's like about 200 attorneys, and we all, everything from municipal to tribal law to representing schools, and we end up doing all these sorts of things, but everyone has started to be a little bit on edge about this whole AI thing. And I guess that to answer the second part, like how it's crept into practice, I mean, a lot of private employers and public entities have started to ask, what policies should we have? How do we train people? How do we adjust? How do students in a classroom, which maybe we can get into later, like, how do we know whether they're actually writing things or not? So that, I feel like that, like coming from a place of ignorance myself, I've always been interested in how we integrate this stuff. So I think Luke's maybe to blame for all of it.
All right. So that's a perfect segue. Luke, I want to get into that AI stuff, but like before I do, can you talk about like what you do in your job on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I've been at this company, Invitae, that I work at now for 4 years. I'm the manager of our applied AI team. We do everything from building our own, usually small in-house models, to integrating open source or cloud models like GPT 3.5 or GPT 4 into application software development applications for our company, which is a genetic testing company. A lot of those applications are used for either helping to speed up operations for certain tasks, helping with interpreting results. Most of it's human in the loop AI stuff, but we own the entire software development process from collecting training data for models to evaluating and training different models to integrating them, deploying them to production, making sure they do well, monitoring models in the wild. And yeah, I've been in the field for a little over a decade now of software development in general. Got my start at Twitter before it was X.
Yes, worked for the several good old days.
Yeah, before Elon. Worked for several academic organizations, Columbia, MIT, doing some...
Small schools, yes. Yeah. Gotcha.
yeah, pretty big spots. And yeah, doing everything from like IT support, kind of DevOps-y type stuff, administration software, as well as lots of development work.
So not law school, clearly.
Nope.
Because of all those words you said. And people are probably like, what the fuck did this guy just say? Okay, so let's run this back for a second. Large language models, artificial intelligence. I've done, I think, like 4 AI presentations this week for legal organizations. And a lot of people haven't even tried like ChatGPT once. So could you distill like a reasonable definition of AI and large language models that you think a layperson would understand?
Sure. I would say AI, artificial intelligence, is best defined by trying to get computers to do tasks that humans do. Whether that's recognizing a picture of something as a dog, or being able to say that handwritten zero or other number on my check is in fact a zero.
Right.
So that I think is a good definition of AI and includes machine learning as a subset of potential artificial intelligence. And then large language models, LLMs, comes from this space of natural language processing within AI, where you're trying to train a model that can understand and really generate or predict the likelihood of the next letter or word in a sequence of letters or words. And that's where models like GPT come in, where really large language models have completely opened up the field of applications for language models by being pretty good at deceiving people into thinking this might have been produced by a human, whether it's a legal document or even a picture of something like some of the image generation models
right.
have grown and become great enough where it's like, oh, this could have been painted by a person or something.
Okay, that was pretty good. I like that. All right, Justin, I'm going to return to you for a second here. So like, given Luke's definitions, which I think are pretty good and understandable, what does a business person slash attorney need to know about AI, like right now?
I think the, like, what was the recent Sam Altman ask, like the $300 trillion question? That question is...
Well, if you answer it, you might be a wealthy man. Go on.
well, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I'm passing the buck to someone else because I truly think that, like, we see all these studies, right? Like GitHub has recently conducted a study where programmers are like 55% more efficient when they're using Copilot. That's GitHub Copilot, so there might be a vested interest there. But like,
perhaps.
Studies refuting that have come out recently as well. It's a contentious topic.
But I think the main point is just like, there's not that metric yet. There's not even the baseline study and then the peer-reviewed study. Like, I think that there's now just like this ambiguity in our space. Like, when I do these conferences, and Jared, we've done them together, like I've I've done them on my own. The first question I always ask is, how many people in the audience have used generative AI in some professional capacity? And it's like three people, and they're all like under the age of 40, which is like five people in the audience. So like the question is always like met with blank stares. And I think that the integration, we've really lagged behind as a profession.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And that's just with the chatbots, right? And like chatbots aren't the end all of generative AI. So it's...
Right. Well, it's funny because I think most people, when they think of AI, they think of, okay, that's ChatGPT, right? But there's tons of different ways that AI manifests itself. So let's talk a little bit about the risk assessment here. Justin, I'm going to stay with you for this one. Lawyers are no fun at parties. Luke, you may know this because they're always assessing risk and trying to fix it. But like you just talked about, like, this is like the Wild West right now. There's no baselines of any kind. It's hard to assess the risk here in a defined way. Mm. And when lawyers look at that, they're like, no, I won't engage this at all. And they have a hard time. Like we were doing a panel last night and one of the panelists was like, well, you know, we're still building guardrails here. And every lawyer was like trying not to throw up in their mouths. So like, how do you get past that if you do? And what's safe and what's not safe? I know I'm asking you all these big questions, but I know you can handle it.
We need a regulatory framework.
Okay.
EU AI has been pretty good at establishing the foundations, but we need something like that in the States. I think that it's probably going to come from the federal government. It's not going to be one of Biden's executive orders. It's going to be something that's like as a result of a committee of AI professionals. I think that it's still going to be completely lacking all the nuance that we need. And everything that gets developed thereafter trying to interpret it in rulemaking or states trying to understand it it's also the latency period is going to be huge there, right? It's always going to lag behind the technology. Like even the stuff that was made to address like GPT-3 has no bearing on multimodal AI. So I think we're always going to be behind from a regulatory standpoint.
And I don't think Joe Biden's fucking around with AI and being like, Dr. Jill, look what I built on ChatGPT. Like, I don't think that's happening. So part of the problem is we got like 80-year-old politicians trying to figure this out, and they don't know their ass from their elbow when it comes to technology. Okay, so Luke, as somebody who's a developer who's kind of building products like this, I assume that your view of risk and testing and assessment is a little bit different than an attorney's would be.
Yeah, I think my view is probably a lot more technical. Like, what can we technically do to eliminate risk? So how can we get some kind of data set where we can do an offline evaluation of how an AI model performs on a given task before we even talk about beta testing it or bringing it into an application? How can we try and keep humans in the loop when we deploy an application? And then how can we do monitoring in the wild of the quality of the model and the stability of the model and the drift of data over time, things like that. But in terms of risk, like the risks are real. There's even if you have all of these safeguards in place from a technical perspective of really good evaluation data sets, and you have like all sorts of dashboards that track the drift of models and make sure the quality on these, the data coming in is good. You still have the model injecting bias that people might learn and then tacitly accept without realizing it. Mm-hmm. And then that may be incorporated into decisions about a patient's care or like a case that impacts someone's life or something like that, depend on the application. So risk is real, and it's all about how can you manage it upfront, during, and after? Like what's your process for improvement? How do you limit the blast radius for the areas where we know things can be bad, like models can hallucinate and create misinformation? And how do you create safeguards against that? And it's hard. A lot of these are like second and third order effects in terms of controlling risk.
I'm so glad you brought up the hallucination thing. We're going to talk about that in a second. But before we do, what do you think of this notion of like disclaimers through the generative AI products? Like I ask a legal question, it says, go hire a lawyer. And then I rephrase the question and it gives me an answer. Like, what's the appropriate level of like control there at this juncture?
I don't know. I think like it makes sense to include disclaimers on upfront pages when you log in or terms of service or things like that. But people start to ignore them really quickly and jailbreak the models as soon as they're confronted by, I want an answer. The model won't give it to me. How can I work around what it's saying? Like, can I say, well, here's a story about my grandmother. And in this story, she really wants to hear this answer. And now can you provide the answer? And usually that all these jailbreaking techniques actually work pretty well for these models. So the constant disclaimers, there's been a lot of negative feedback, especially with ChatGPT and some of the other, you know, like Gemini, Bard, like other competitive models where people say, just do away with them. Like we don't want to see them constantly coming at us.
Right.
I mean, I have to feel like in my mind, if you're actually committed to building a pipe bomb in your basement, you're not going to be deterred by GPT saying it's unethical to build a pipe bomb in your basement. So really the like the people who are getting, you know, losing the quality of what the generative AI could otherwise provide because of the like proliferation of disclaimers are the people who you shouldn't be worried about doing some terrible thing with the model. And like, I feel like there's enough AI models out there that are like open source, the premium AI models that the Geminis, the OpenAIs, the Bing or Bard, like these aren't going to be the ones people use to do the terrible thing that all the disclaimers are mostly worried about. You know, like in my mind, I feel like that's where the disclaimers should back off. And then we should maybe have a little bit more nuance with the user can actually have some degree of education when using these models.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And then not even terrible, but like just mildly irritating things to some professionals like accessing self-help legal. Okay, yeah. So Luke, you brought up this hallucination thing. And I don't know if you and Justin have been talking about this, but there's been a lot of news stories lately about lawyers who are generating legal briefs in generative AI tools. They have fake cases because the AI is hallucinating. So what does that mean and why does it happen?
Yeah, so I think Justin already mentioned the Avianca case, which is one of those earlier, maybe the earliest case that became really well publicized where
I think so, yeah.
A lawyer got slapped on the wrist for actually was forced to now get wet signatures on each document they provide because of using a brief that referenced fake cases generated by your model. And the only fact-checking that lawyer did was asking the model, were these real cases or not? Which if the model's already making things up, it will just make up the answer. Yes, they are real.
It's like, Bill, these cases are real.
Whatever you want. But yeah, so what's happening under the hood there is these models, when predicting and generating the next word or combining different facts and pieces of information in its pre-training corpus, the set of information it was trained on, which for some of the large models is like a huge chunk of the internet, and synthesizing that into information that may be entirely fabricated. And the problem with the model is, in many cases, depending on the model and the application, because I say that because there are some applications now where you can ground the answers with first sources, but you know, ChatGPT doesn't always do that when you're chatting with it. And like the hallucination comes about as a result of synthesizing information that doesn't necessarily belong together and isn't an accurate answer. And when you asked if it is an accurate answer, the model can't say for sure.
That was a good explanation. Okay, so Justin, back to you. You're a lawyer. AI may be hallucinating on you. How do you deal with that? Is it simply like double checking the information? Or is there more to it?
If there's more to it, I don't know. I think it's like with anything else that you use for legal research. So people have this conception of legal research as like confined to the revered halls of like some august institution or like
all the places Luke used to work. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, basically. But like, you know, LexisNexis or Westlaw, and most of the lawyers I talk to are using Google Scholar, using Reddit, you know, to find the raw data they need. And then they'll go confirm before they make the argument to a judge. And so it's the same thing. Like when if I'm looking up like what the statute of limitations are for a certain crime, I'm then watching my Reddit page. I'm looking at r/lawyering and then this sub thread of like statute of limitations. And then I click on this comment and it's great. And it says all of these things and it cites to a case. And it's not like I copy and paste that into my brief. Like I'm going to go to Westlaw. I'm going to shepherdize that site. I'm going to make sure that it's good authority. And only then will I put it into my brief. And I think that like these skills have been there all along. They're hammered out in law school. Like before generative AI existed, yeah. I went to law school and like, that's really the only thing I can say. I went to law school before and now like the same principles apply. Check the site, check the work. And like, it's such a baseline skill that it's surprising everyone's getting all up in arms about it.
I know. Okay. Sticking with you, Justin, for one more question. Legal tech has started to implement AI here and there. What do you think of the current products and where do you think this goes?
I think the current products are good. I've used Westlaw's AI products. Case Text has a good product. I haven't experimented as widely as you have, Jared, with a lot of the products, but in my mind, the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. And through a couple of common sense procedures, you can be almost as certain as before AI existed that you're not making the mistakes that are commonly attributed to using AI in practice.
Excellent. Okay, Justin, Luke, thank you for coming on. That was fun. Will you stick around for one last segment? We got one more thing to do with you.
Absolutely.
Sure.
All right, we'll take one final sponsor break so you can hear more about what our sponsor companies are doing and their latest offerings. Then stay tuned, as always, for the Rump Roast. It's even more supple than the roast beast. Contract automation isn't a trend. It's a strategic imperative. Though big players in the e-sign world will make you believe implementing it will cost you big bucks and more than a few headaches, it doesn't have to be that way. DocuBee is an easy-to-onboard, full suite of products that includes e-signature, brilliant workflow capabilities, and AI contract automation at nearly half the price of those out-of-touch behemoths. The one thing DocuBee doesn't automate? Their customer service. Visit get.docubee.com/contracts to set up a call with a real live person. DocuBee will be with you every step of the way.
Hey, Gee, what's up?
Just having some lunch, Conrad.
Hey, Gee, do you see that billboard out there?
Oh, you mean that guy out there in the gray suit?
Yeah, the gray suit guy.
There's all those beautiful, rich, leather-bound books in the background.
That is exactly the one. That's J.D. McGuffin at law. He'll fight for you!
I bet you he has got so many years of experience.
Like decades and decades. And I bet, Gee, I bet he even went to a law school.
Are you a lawyer? Do you suffer from dull marketing and a lack of positioning in a crowded legal marketplace? Sit down with Gee and Conrad for Lunch Hour Legal Marketing on the Legal Talk Network, available wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the rear end of the Legal Toolkit podcast. That's right, it's the Rump Roast. It's a grab bag of short form topics, all of my choosing. You may be wondering, why do I get to pick? Well, that's because I'm the host. Now, Justin and Luke, aside from my brother and I, who's been on the show before, you're the first set of brothers to ever appear on the podcast. So I obviously want to take advantage of this opportunity by quizzing you on famous sets of brothers, you know, other than yourselves. It's a segment I'm going to call Brother Up. But before we do that, as I recall, I did a lot of fucked up shit to my siblings when I was younger. So I want to ask you guys, like, what's the worst thing you did to each other when you were kids?
I got a lead with this one.
Okay,
we used to zip Justin up into a snowsuit and throw him into a bush that had a hornet's nest in it. And we did it multiple times. And we put on, my dad had like a, it wasn't like a welding goggles, but some kind of face shield. And it would be in the middle of the summer. And he would come out and all the hornets would be sticking into the snowsuit. They wouldn't sting him. And you could pluck them off of it, but that was not nice.
That's pretty shitty. Okay. Justin, how did you award this behavior?
I became a lawyer because I realized the cosmic unfairness of the universe and that I had to learn the rules to protect myself. No, I don't know. I feel like I didn't do that much. Like, Luke was 3.5 years older than I was. He was bigger than I was and smarter. Yeah. So we played Stick Wars a lot, where we'd
stick
go in
wars?
Our backyard.
Is that what I think it is? Just beating each other with sticks?
Not beating, throwing them at each other. So like, you would have one side of a tree and then someone else would be like 2 feet away on the other side and you'd actually throw them instead of hit them. But yeah, probably a good headshot or torso shot with a stick was the worst I did.
Little more strategy involved in stick wars than just like slashing at each other with sticks. All right, that was better than I could have hoped. All right, let's let the games begin. I got five trivia questions for you. We're going to start off with a real easy one. This pair of brothers were first in flight. I know you guys know.
Right, right? Brothers.
Yeah, we're one for one. Okay, so let's make it a little tougher. These famous rappers are actually brothers. I'm going to give you multiple choice. 50 Cent and Big Daddy Kane, Snow and Tupac, or Warren G and Dr. Dre. 50 Cent and Big Daddy Kane, Snow and Tupac, or Warren G and Dr. Dre. Actual brothers. Who do you think it is?
I'm going with C.
I was leaning towards C too.
Correct. And I tried to trick you here because Warren G and Dr. Dre are actually stepbrothers. Dr. Dre's mom married Warren G's dad. You didn't go for Snow and Tupac, huh? That was probably the right choice. All right, you're two for two. We'll see if you can get to five for five. These three brothers are actually bears. Bears, the animals. Sometimes you see black bears in Maine. Here are your choices. Grizz, Panda, and Ice Bear. Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, and Willis, or Sunny, Brownie, and Salmon Chase. So Grizz, Panda, and Ice Bear, Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, and Willis, or Sunny, Brownie, and Salmon and Chase. Bear brothers.
Are they like brothers, like literally brothers, or somebody like... Is this like an Instagram bear trio or something?
Yeah, what is C?
They could be adoptive brothers also. They could even be different types of bears.
I'm leaning towards B. What do you think, Jess?
Yeah, B sounds right.
B is incorrect. But this is good. You guys are doing great. Grizz, Panda, and Ice Bear are on a Comedy Central show or maybe Cartoon Network called We Bear Bears. Have you seen this show?
No. Mm-hmm.
Really funny show that my kids watch. It's a polar bear, a panda, and a grizzly bear. And they are a set of brothers. Everybody check that out. All right, we're still doing good. You're like over 50%. I'm pleased with the results so far. Here's another one that I think is probably in your wheelhouse. You just might find these brothers at a Dunkin' Donuts location. Ben and Casey Affleck. Frank and Jesse James or Cain and Abel?
The Affleck brothers, right?
Yeah. One of my favorite SNL sketches ever. That's the Vanilla Nut Taps episode. That's great. What's your favorite flavor of coffee? All right. You guys are doing great. 3 out of 4. We got one left. These twin brothers lived the sweet life on Disney Channel for 3 seasons. Fred and Ben Savage, Cole and Dylan Sprouse, or Mortimer and Mickey Mouse. I think you guys were ready for this one.
No, I thought you were going to say Drake and Josh.
No. See, I'm trying to test, like, okay, which shows on the Disney Channel did you guys watch?
We didn't have cable, so we're...
Of course you didn't.
You were
outside beating the shit out of each other with sticks. Okay. Fred and Ben Savage, Cole and Dylan Sprouse, or Mortimer and Mickey Mouse?
Cole and Dylan Sprouse is my guess.
Yeah, I'm with that.
Correct. All right, you guys remember the Wonder Years with Fred Savage? That was way back in the day. Oh, wow, I'm so fucking old. Okay.
We would watch, they had videos of, like, you know, like the public announcements channel where when the dump was open? Like, it's like the dump's open like 9 to 11:30, then lunch is 11:30 to 12:30. Oh,
yeah. That's what you would watch.
Yeah, then it'd like pan onto the next screen, and it's like a knitting community event, and it was like, that's what the programming was where we were picking up the signal.
Like, hey, everybody, dump's open. We gotta get the fuck out of here. You guys kicked ass on the Rump Roast. The AI stuff was great. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks again.
Thanks, Jared.
If you want to find out more about Justin and his work at Drum & Woodsum, visit dwmlaw.com. That's dwmlaw.com. If you want to find out more about Luke and his work at Invite, visit invite.com. That's INVITAE.com. INVITAE.com. Check them both out. I'm sure their mom will be happy. Now, for those of you listening in Medibemps, Maine, we've got a Spotify playlist that's going to knock your wool socks right off your feet, perhaps onto the L.L. Bean vest you have on your floor. It's songs about siblings, brothers, sisters, stepbrothers, and stepsisters. It's all on the table. Now, sadly, I've run out of time today to tell you why I think the Tyrannosaurus Rex has such small arms, but I will let you know that I believe that part of the reason is so that they could work on the carnival circuit. This is Jared Correa reminding you to take off your shoes before you come into my house, or I'll fucking kill you.
If you're a lawyer running a solo or small firm and you're looking for other lawyers to talk through issues you're currently facing in your practice, join the Unbillable Hours Community Roundtable, a free virtual event on the third Thursday of every month. Lawyers from all over the country come together and meet with me, lawyer and law firm management consultant Christopher T. Anderson, to discuss best practices on topics such as marketing, client acquisition, hiring and firing, and time management. The conversation is free to join, but requires a simple reservation. The link to RSVP can be found on the Unbillable Hour page at LegalTalkNetwork.com. We'll see you there.